So, hey, Patrick.
Hi, Dan. How's it going?
It's going well, and I am excited to be doing our first true episode of Whiskey and IR Theory in space.
Oh, this is going to be loads of fun.
Once I get my standalone mixer up, I think I can add some of those sound effects.
That's right. That's right.
Probably do it in post-production, too. But
a little reverb, you know.
Yeah, sure. It's a little bit more, I don't know, it's more homey when we try to do it with our voices.
That's one way to describe it. Yes, that's good.
So if you didn't listen to or you got bored with our intro episode, what we've decided to do, what this series is about, is that we're going through various versions of the science fiction and politics / international relations / social science / whatever syllabuses that we've done. And we are going to treat you all, whether you like it or not, to, you can always turn it off if you don't like it, a combination of our longstanding science fiction courses. That's what we're going to do.
Very, very longstanding. I think I wrote the first version of a potential sci-fi syllabus or something like it when I was about 15. And it was Watchmen. It was reading Watchmen and going, ooh, Watchmen and Ender's Game are like real books. You should really be able to like do these in class. And my English teacher actually agreed with me. So we got to do both books in an English class when I was in 10th grade.
Okay.
So it's been thinking about this for a long time.
You see, I think about it more as a way of recapturing those late night bullshit sessions in high school and college with your fellow nerds.
Yes. And given that I was at boarding school, a lot of our English class in 10th grade involved late night bullshit sessions with nerds. So, agreed.
So what we're doing today is we're doing an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, which is called The Outcast. It came out in 1992, is the fifth season of Star Trek. So in the period when Star Trek The Next Generation is reaching the peak of its popularity. Mm-hmm. It is definitely going strong when they do this episode. Yeah. And it's actually generally a pretty strong season.
Oh, yeah. Season 5 is one of the best overall seasons. Some of the best Next Generation episodes ever occur in later seasons, but the seasons get a little more uneven. 5 is just all cylinders all the time.
I don't know whether it's 5 or not, but it is later in the show that they start becoming less mechanical and static with their shooting techniques. Mm-hmm. Two. Mm-hmm. I think this is, they haven't quite made that transition in season 5, but it's visually more interesting to watch too.
Agreed.
So this is a work that it's the first thing I assign. And sometimes, and in fact, recently I've actually basically said, you go watch this and you write me an essay about it. Just cold. We're not going to talk about it. You're going to write your reaction to it. In recent years, I've also been showing a Supergirl episode called Man of Steel, because The Outcast is from 1992. It is 30 years old. It was closer to the end of Star Trek, the original series, than we are to it now.
Head explode.
Right. And a lot of my students aren't necessarily familiar with Star Trek.
Right.
Not that they're all like, were rabid CW watchers when they were 12 or 13. But the thing I like about the Supergirl episode is that it's a very Weinmann liberal way of trying to understand what Trumpism is. Mm. If that makes sense. And maybe we should watch it. You should watch it and see whether we want to talk about it or not. I'm not sure it's worth an entire episode.
I'll put it on the list.
Okay. I can't imagine that many people are listening to this. Yeah, Patrick's getting out the scotch. So, why don't you talk about the scotch?
So, actually, this is a good segue into talking a little bit about Star Trek, because the sole reason that I have chosen this particular scotch, besides the fact that it's really yummy, this is Port Charlotte, made by the Brooklottie Distillery. But the particular kind that this is called 2007 CC:01. And the CC in this case actually stands for Cognac Cask 01. It's been finished in cognac casks. But the CC:01 puts me in mind of the registry number of the USS Enterprise, which is, of course, the ship that a lot of Star Trek, particularly Star Trek Next Generation, takes place on, which is NCC-1701. Now, technically, it's the Enterprise D, but I don't know how much Star Trek history we have to get into here, but the fact that it's CC01 struck me as an appropriate reason to drag out this particular bottle of whiskey for this particular episode. So let me pop that open here.
So I actually considered buying an overpriced gimmick label Chateau Picard. I think it's a cab. Anyway, I thought very seriously about buying a bottle of this, but $70 for mediocre wine, just no, not going to do it.
No, that's not worth it. This is actually really yummy scotch. Okay. So
where is it from?
It is the Brooklady Distillery, which is an Islay.
And so your favorite variety.
My favorite variety. This was a travel exclusive, so I think I got this one in Heathrow. It is delicious. This is the third bottle of this stuff that I've had. You can't find it anymore. But it has probably been the bottle of scotch I have gone through the fastest of any bottle of scotch that I have purchased. So it's just really, really good. Nice and grainy. It's
giving me this warming sensation very quickly.
Yeah.
It's spreading in my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you describe it?
It's... I don't know. The thing that always gets me about this is that it's very I don't know, cereally, right? There's kind of a not quite a puffed grain feel to it, but there's something very 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 kind of bready about it, which I enjoy a lot. That combination of the way they've finished it and just the sheer level of peating. Because the Port Charlotte, like the Octomore line that Brooklady also makes, is some of the most heavily peated stuff around. So.
We're talking about this before we started to record, and the question is, do we need to explain Star Trek? And the answer was, yeah, probably. So I think you were going to take a stab at that?
Yeah, I'll give it a start. So Star Trek was the brainchild of this guy named Gene Roddenberry, who was a script writer and director and producer in television in early days, was responsible for doing a number of sort of westerns and other sorts of shows, had this idea for what he called, what he thought of as wagon train to the stars. You're going to put a group of people on a journey into space, and you're going to see kind of what happens. And it took him forever to find funding, and eventually it got picked up, oddly enough, by Lucille Ball's company, was the main financial supporter, Desilu Productions, that did it. And Star Trek is set in the original series is set in the 24th century or 23rd century?
I think it's
23rd. Because Next Gen is set in the 24th century.
I believe so, but let me check that.
Yeah, let's check and make sure that we're being accurate about this. So Star Trek features a group called the United Federation of Planets, which humans are taking a leading role in.
Mid-22nd century through the late 24th century in Star Trek Picard, and then in Discovery we have way in the future.
Gotcha.
Eventually.
Gotcha. Okay. And it's interesting, even trying to tell kind of the internal story of the Star Trek mythology gets weird because
there's a lot of lore, and there's a lot of stuff, particularly in the original series, which is not consistent with what's become canon.
And the United Federation of Planets doesn't actually make an appearance until the second season of the old series. They don't even mention it in the first season because they sort of hadn't invented it yet. But as the lore has become canonized, there is, in the 22nd, 23rd centuries, there is a United Federation of Planets that Earth takes a leading role in. There are other aliens in the galaxy that are affiliated and members of the United Federation of Planets, the Vulcans, Mr. Spock. Again, these are more pop cultural figures that even people who don't know Star Trek have hopefully heard of. And so the United Federation of Planets is not just humans, but humans are kind of paramount within it. They are exploring space and interacting with a number of other more hostile alien races over time. One of the things Roddenberry was very concerned to show is how humans could get along in the future. Star Trek is kind of relentlessly optimistic in many ways. So the human civilization has become kind of unified. There aren't wars between human beings.
There is a variation in the way that Star Trek showrunners have understood the canon and the Bible, but the basic notion is that it is a post-scarcity utopia, even though they wind up working around that because in order for various kind of narrative and plot purposes.
Right. But the idea is that humans are at peace with one another, that the Starfleet, which is the organization that controls the spaceships, is a scientific exploration group for
scientific
the most part.
And peaceful.
Peaceful. They are armed. There are conflicts that occur between representatives of the Federation and those outside. There are occasional, you know, pirates or whatever. But for the most part, what we get is a future in which human beings are peacefully exploring the galaxy. That's kind of the overarching thing. And the old series, the original Star Trek series, featured representatives of different nationalities and ethnicities all serving together in peace on the bridge, including a Russian character. So this is
a Russian
Cold
character,
War.
Not a Russian
not actor. A Russian actor, because Walter Koenig, not so much a Russian
nuclear vessels.
And not a Russian accent.
Not a Russian accent, but someone who was able to sort of portray a Russian. And you had George Takei playing Hikaru Sulu, so you had, and of course remember the time period we're talking about here, to have a Japanese character on the bridge of what looked like a, Roddenberry modeled a lot of this on U.S. naval ships, to have a Japanese character serving proudly on the bridge of what looks like a U.S. naval warship in space so soon after the end of the Second World War is a very interesting statement that Roddenberry's making.
And plus, and probably even more, what's the word I'm looking for? More breakthrough-y is that Anna Uhuru, who's played by
Nichelle Nichols.
The story is, and I, you know, the story is what the story is, that she was getting a little frustrated with the fact that mostly she was the comms officer and mostly she's answering the telephone more or less. But apparently civil rights leaders said it was really important for her to stay on, you know, to see.
Right. And not just civil rights leaders, but Dr. King. Like came to her and said, no, you need to do this because you are presenting a different vision.
And she speaks Swahili.
And she speaks Swahili and all manner of things. So this was Roddenberry's initial kind of take on all of this. Star Trek is, let's say, not a success. It's around, it runs its three seasons, and then it kind of disappears. But what's fascinating is, after the series is canceled, is when its popularity really takes off. Because fans start mobilizing around the show. And there's such a huge sort of fan demand that there start to be some, you know, gatherings, conventions, and so on. And then with the giant success of Star Wars in 1977, Paramount decided, hey, we should make films.
According to the material I just read for today, it's a little bit different than that. So Star Trek did better than you might think. It wasn't like a rating smash, but it was also very expensive to produce.
Right.
So the balance of that was not favorable for it, but it did incredibly well in syndication and had enormous staying power, huge fan base. I mean, the fan base helped save the show for its final season.
Absolutely.
Through a letter campaign. But the figures on the syndication is like the most syndicated show ever in its post-original run, or at least at the time. And so Paramount realized they had this really hot property with this big fan base, and they were going to make a film. Then Star Wars came out. They thought they couldn't compete, and they moved forward with Phase 2, which was supposed to be the second series. Then they changed their minds. And they decided to make films instead. So Phase 2 got put on hold. And this, at least one of the, I think the Wikipedia article suggests that part of the reason they decided to go ahead with The Next Generation was the salaries that Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner demanded and got for Star Trek IV were so high that we need actors we don't have to pay a bajillion dollars to.
That all sounds plausible. This is a different story than the one I'm familiar with. So, neat. No, certainly Star Trek.
Wikipedia is never wrong, as we know.
Never, never. I mean, just anecdotally, I know my exposure to Star Trek was Star Trek in syndication.
I used to watch it on our little TV. Yep. Was really excited whenever it came on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it had merchandise at that point. I mean, I had a Spock doll. I really like Spock.
I had a small Enterprise.
Yeah.
But my dad had watched the original series
when it was
first out. And so he would always find when it was going, and it would show up at weird times, 3 p.m. on Saturday or something. And then we would go in and we would watch it. And it was great. And I remember seeing some of the extreme fans, because they would host like 2 episodes in a row, but there would be a couple fans who would like introduce it, and then they would show an episode, and then they would talk about it, and then they would show the next episode. So it was like a little Star Trek feature that would go on in the afternoon, which was my first exposure to, wow, there are people who really like television shows. That's cool. Anyway, so the vision of Star Trek, which Roddenberry kind of started with this and then sort of carries on through the films, is this idea of this post-scarcity utopia where human beings are getting along, where it's peaceful exploration. He had always had in mind to do this Phase 2 or second version of, you know, of continuing adventures of Star Trek.
I think one of the scripts in The Next Generation was originally a Phase 2 script.
Mm.
And there's some interesting trivia about Phase 2, which is going to become relevant in our discussion of The Outcast.
Mm-hmm. So eventually then what gets greenlit is this thing called Star Trek The Next Generation. It's supposed to be set, I think it's 70?
I think it's a century.
Century?
Roughly a century.
Roughly a century afterwards? Yeah, because McCoy shows up in the first episode. Yeah. And so I guess he's supposed to be like 140 by that point or something, maybe? I don't know. So it's the titular ship is still the same, the Enterprise. And this is an entirely different crew. It is a different Starfleet in a lot of ways. The universe, the galaxy looks a little bit different at this point. There's the antagonism between the Federation and the Klingon Empire, which was a big deal in the old series, has sort of changed.
Yes, the old series, the general allegorical reading is that the Klingons are kind of a stand-in for the Russians or the Chinese, or maybe the Romulans or the Chinese, who the heck knows. But they sort of have a Cold War very strong Cold War overcast. And part of the thing for a 1987 show, both because of the time, but also because of the outlook of a kind of Roddenberry approach, was that they decided they were going to have a Klingon in Starfleet, although he's a Klingon who was raised by humans, etc. But to signal the way in which the Federation is no longer quite as antagonistic with the Klingons, and right. in some degree, a not unproblematic partnership.
Right. And that becomes interesting as the series goes on. But also kind of importantly for our purposes, the command structure of the starships in the Federation is kind of based on U.S. naval precedence. You have a captain, you have a first officer, you have a number of other kinds of bridge positions, and the lines of authority are sort of reasonably well worked out in terms of that. So it's definitely a military organization, but it is a military organization that's devoted to peaceful exploration. So a lot of what the Enterprise is doing, the typical plot of most Star Trek.
And we should say this is an episodic program.
Absolutely.
Because some of the current incarnations of Star Trek are not episodic. They are peak television, single story arcs. So if you're watching Picard or Discovery, they are not of the structure. So you'd have a 45-minute episode that would, you'd go through some plot, some mystery, some conflict, its resolution, it would end. The fans used to say that the reset button would be hit, in the sense that there wouldn't be that much movement forward. You could go on to the next episode. You wouldn't have to follow that much. Now, the Next Generation did develop some arcs that occurred slowly over seasons, but they weren't, you know, it wasn't a continuous storyline. And it was rare when they had a two-part episode, for example.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Most things would happen would be resolved within that 1 hour time or 42 minutes or whatever the actual screen time of it is. And occasionally you get references back to things. As far as I know, this particular episode doesn't ever get referred to again.
Yeah, one of the criticisms of it is that it disappears without a ripple, which doesn't make a lot of sense given some of the things that happen in it.
Yeah, I mean, this should have had more effect.
Beyond the narrative structure and beyond the point they want to make, they have to hit the reset button here,
right,
for a variety of longer term narrative reasons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it feels a little bit preordained, a little bit like the structure of the show is kind of driving some of how the resolution happens.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. But so that I guess the one other thing you need to know, or listeners need to know, is the Federation has one central rule. And that central rule is called the Prime Directive. And the Prime Directive states that the Federation can't interfere with the natural course of the development of various species that it encounters. Now, hang on. I know what you're about to say. Yeah, all I'm doing is stating the rule.
You're stating one version of the rule. The Prime Directive tends to morph. But go on. But the point is the Prime Directive is super important.
Right.
And it is, no matter how it is cashed out,
mm-hmm.
it is supposed to be a guiding principle. And it is a principle of non-interference.
It's a non-interference principle.
So it's like no imperialism is essentially one way to read it.
Right. So they can study other species, but they can't interfere in what they're doing.
Now, the way it's often articulated is that they can't interfere in the activities of a pre-warp civilization. But during the run of the show, it also seems to get applied to post-warp civilizations.
Right.
So
right.
make it that way you will.
And warp, by the way, is Star Trek speak for faster-than-light travel. Which, of course, if they didn't have faster-than-light travel, there'd be a lot of time sitting around between the stars.
But what's interesting is that they don't start out with the concept of warp. They introduce it as time warp.
This is the captain. Our destination is the Talos Star Group. Our time warp, Factor 7.
Then it becomes warp. In theory, a warp drive, if you could have the energy to do it, which is the big problem, would allow for effectively, de facto, not actual, faster-than-light travel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is another piece that sort of... interesting, at least, about Star Trek. Star Trek tries very hard to be scientifically plausible.
Well, it tries hard in Next Generation onward when they have consultants, not right. so much in the original series.
Well, in the original series, yeah. you know, the original series becomes an awful lot of Monster of the Week. Mm. But certainly by the time you get to the Next Generation and subsequent
the
series...
The monster was us all along.
Yeah. No, but they do a very elaborate job of trying to make their physics either plausible or at least internally consistent. So things will be introduced and tachyons and subspace and so on. And these will show up in the same kind of order. So you get kind of a fake physics that underpins a lot
of Star
Trek.
The technical term is technobabble.
I suppose, except this is better than ordinary technobabble.
Yeah, they had consultants, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's important with situating Star Trek. It is very much a science fiction series in the sense that this is a disenchanted world in which there aren't gods and magic. Instead, there are scientifically plausible explanations, naturalistic explanations for phenomena.
In fact, more than once in the original series, they meet a godlike being or an actual Earth god. And they're always an alien with a power source or incredibly advanced. You know, the principle that, you know, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, that undergirds a lot of the series. So it is not just not particularly interested in an enchanted world. It is actively disenchanting. Now, the exception to this is Deep Space Nine, which gets a little bit complicated because even though there is a naturalistic explanation for the wormhole aliens, aka the gods of Bajor, more or less the prophets, there is much more interest in faith.
Right.
And in part, that was Ron Moore pushing the envelope of what the Star Trek Bible would allow and trying to do things that he'd later do in Battlestar Galactica.
Right. So. Right. But Next Generation, we don't really have a lot of that. And every time you run into religion of or faith of any sort, it's usually either a delusion or it's something that has to be explained.
It's often a system of oppression.
Yes.
So we get, you know, a computer who is pretending to be God and ruling people. This is, by the way, wonderfully satirized and expanded on in Lower Decks, which you have not seen because you don't have a subscription to Paramount.
Yeah. And that's one other thing we should probably mention here about the importance of Star Trek as a televised text, particularly these older things.
Yes, there are sort of 3.5 iterations of Star Trek, right? There's the original series. There are the first 6 films. The 6th one is the last one with the original cast, and it actually overlaps with the Next Generation era. There's the Next Generation era, which has the Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager. So you had 3 shows come in this era. Enterprise is kind of, I guess, a half. I sort of think of it as the last gasp of that era, even though it's set before the formation of the Federation.
Right.
Then we get Star Trek off the air, and then it comes back 4 or 5 years ago with Discovery as a leader to get people to subscribe to Paramount Plus. Discovery has now spawned Star Trek Picard, which is in the next season just going to be like the final story of the Next Generation. And then the really best of these, which is Strange New Worlds, which is just basically the Enterprise as it existed before Kirk was captain, under its prior captain, with Spock and familiar figures doing Star Trek-y things, having an alien race or a moral dilemma or a comedic episode a week.
No, that's good stuff. Now, of course, the difference is that that third phase has been mostly on streaming pay services.
There's also a kids cartoon, which is actually one of the extensions of the Next Generation era timeline. But the audience is not what the Next Generation was, and they've never met the Next Generation numbers.
Right.
Even though I think a lot of us believe that Deep Space Nine is peak Star Trek.
Yes.
But it seems to be successful for them. They're spinning off more and more. It's not as widely viewed, I don't think, at least in the United States, because it's paywalled.
Yeah. I remember in high school, I remember showings of Next Generation on whatever syndicated network were like events. People would monopolize one of the common rooms and be able to watch that. And so you'd get a whole bunch of people sort of there. It had much more widespread circulation, I think.
The Star Trek universe and the people behind it conceptualized the show as very left-wing. Now, there's a whole set of critical commentary about to what degree they actually are. Some of that is maybe relevant for this episode, but it's important to know. Right. It's important to know that it is self-consciously a progressive show.
Right.
So it featured the first interracial kiss on network television, although it was coerced, so they have a kind of positive liability. They also, I think, feature the first network or syndicated female-female kiss, but that is also has a in-universe explanation. Discovery has a gay couple, or was one of the anchors, a male gay couple, and has introduced trans and non-binary characters. So it's been pushing that further. So this episode is the Next Generation attempt to do a gay rights episode.
Yes, I think that is, I think that's fair.
Well, they're explicit about it. They talk about it that way. But it's done in a science fiction-y way. So we get a little bit of that cognitive estrangement that's supposed to convince people who might not be convinced if you just like said, gays should have rights. So when I was deciding what I was going to show, I briefly considered an original series episode called Let This Be Your Last Battleground.
Oh, yeah.
Which is even more ham-handed because it features two aliens who want to kill one another. One of them is being pursued by the other one for 50,000 years. Civil war on their planet. They're aliens who are black and white. They're half black and half white. And the big reveal, if you didn't notice beforehand, is when the Enterprise crew is like,
it is obvious the most simple-minded that Loci is of an inferior breed.
The obvious visual evidence, Commissioner, is that he is of the same breed as yourself.
Are you blind, Commander Spock? Look at me. Look at me.
You're black on one side and white on the other.
I am black on the right side.
I fail to see the significant difference.
Loci is white on the right side. All of his people are white on the right side.
And when they get back to their planet, finally, it's all been destroyed. And even the images we get are of cities that look post-riot. So,
yeah,
it's not subtle.
No,
not at all.
Nothing in the old series of Star Trek is even the slightest bit subtle.
I have been rewatching some episodes that I think have some interesting stuff going on.
There's interesting stuff, but it's very...
Like, Balance of Terror, I think, is a more...
Okay, I'll give you that. It's a better... I mean, yeah, it's not the Omega Glory.
Yes, I think the Omega Glory is widely understood to be not in canon.
It would sort of have to be.
Okay, we're getting way too... So we need to talk about The Outcast.
Yeah, we need to talk about The Outcast.
I show this because... It is, in many ways, incredibly ham-handed.
Mm-hmm.
But there's more to it than that. So we should talk a little bit about the plot. So
right.
It's an alien race a week. And we are told in the cold open that the Enterprise has come to assist a race that we've never met before.
Captain's log, stardate 456-14.6. We have been contacted by an androgynous race called the Janai. To investigate the mysterious disappearance of one of their shuttlecraft.
Captain.
And Janai are an androgynous species that do not have gender. And this is told to us immediately in the voiceover, because this is considered unusual, different. If you actually read the script, it describes the Janai as all being very attractive, striking, chiseled, thin, willowy, etc.
Interesting.
And there's some techno thing going on about how this might be the first instance of null space observed. But the primary plot involves Commander Riker, who is the second command of the Enterprise, and is the resident rake at times.
All times that are. I mean, Riker will sleep with anything.
The funny thing about this is that Riker is a hyperbole of Kirk, because... Right. If you watch some of the original series, and certainly if you watch the J.J. Abrams reboot,
right,
you tend to have this image of Kirk as being a rake and very promiscuous and would sleep with anything. But if you actually watch the show, that's not fair.
Right.
He is not actually just chasing tail. Oftentimes when he is going with a romance, it's because he's trying to protect the ship or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So Riker is this aspect of Kirk embodied and dialed up to 11.
Right, exactly.
So he is working with... a particular Janai named Soren. As the episode progresses, they fall in love. Interspersed with them falling in love is a lot of discussion of what does gender mean? What does it mean to not have gender?
Mm-hmm.
Why do the women have makeup on in the show and the men not have makeup on? Soren makes clear that this has to be secret because not only is the norm androgynous, but it is considered perversity and a form of deviance to express a gender preference and to be gendered. What happens when people are discovered to be gendered is they get something called psychotechnic treatment, which is supposed to cure them.
And it is important to note that Soren and Riker becoming involved is precipitated by Soren confessing to Riker that she feels and has always felt female.
Yes.
So she is, by the definitions of Janai society, a perversion. She is sick in their terms.
And we learn about the way that they handle this kind of variation, this kind of quote-unquote deviance, because she tells a story about somebody she was in school with who was gendered male.
I've known I was different all my life. But I did not know how or why until I was older.
And when you realized, what then?
I remember when I was very young. Before I knew what I was, there was a rumor at my school that one of the students preferred a gender, in that case, male. The children started making fun of him, and every day they were more cruel. They could tell he was afraid, and somehow that seemed to encourage them. One morning in class, he appeared, bleeding and in ripped clothes. He said he had fallen down. And of course, the school authorities found out and took him away and gave him psychotactic treatments. When he came back, he stood in front of the whole school and told us how happy he was now that he had been cured. After that, I realized how dangerous it was to be different. And once I got older and knew what I was terrified. I have had to live with that fear ever since.
Now, there's a lot going on here in terms of what happens in the intervening space, but ultimately they're discovered. Thorin gets a hearing, gives a speech, which is very clearly a speech that could be a gay rights speech. Right. Hits all the notes. It's actually a pretty good speech. Says that, you know, why would you go after us? We don't do anything to you.
I'm tired of lies. I am female. I was born that way. I have had those feelings, those longings, all of my life. It is not unnatural. I am not sick because I feel this way. I do not need to be helped. I do not need to be cured. What I need, and what all of those who are like me need, is your understanding and your compassion. We have not injured you in any way. And yet we are scorned and attacked. And all because we are different. What we do is no different from what you do. We talk and laugh. We complain about work, and we wonder about growing old. We talk about our families, and we worry about the future. And we cry with each other when things seem hopeless. All of the loving things that you do with each other, that is what we do. And for that, we are called misfits and deviants and criminals. What right do you have to punish us? What right do you have to change us? What makes you think you can dictate how people love each other?
Then she's taken away. And Riker is so upset by this that he wants to go mount a mission to rescue her. Picard says, you can't do this because of the Prime Directive. But it becomes very clear that Picard is hanging out, giving him the opportunity to do this just in an unsanctioned way. And he beams down along with Worf to the surface. And this is significant because Worf is the appropriate character to play this role. Plays the, I don't like these funny androgynous
species. Founded in 2161, so... Twos, sixes, and aces are wild.
That is a woman's game.
Oh, why is that?
All those wild cards. They support a weak hand. A man's game has no wild cards.
Let me get this straight. You're saying it's a woman's game because women are weak and need more help.
Yes.
And just this afternoon, I was insisting to one of the Genii that those attitudes were but a distant memory.
The Genii. They bother me.
Why, Worf?
Well, they just do. They're all alike. No males, no females.
Well, I'm sure we're just as strange to them.
Well, one of them seems to be overcoming the differences, at least in regards to one of us.
What are you saying, Doctor?
I could be wrong, but I get the definite impression that Sorin is attracted to Commander Riker.
Human and a Genii. Impossible.
Why?
Good question. Worf?
All these wild cards. It is difficult to know what is exactly in my hand. However, I will open with 50.
Is still willing to go down and sacrifice his career
right
in this noble pursuit. So they beam down. They identify where Sorin is. They beam down to rescue her. And they take out some guards. And then Sorin basically has had the treatment and says, I'm so sorry, you know, that you got caught up in this. I recognize now I was wrong. I was perverse and, you know.
Mm-hmm. I was sick. I'm well
sick. I'm
now.
Better now. Mm-hmm. And Riker says, you know, but I love you. Sorin looks at Riker and looks sad and walks away. When Riker gets back to the Enterprise, that's when Picard makes that comment about how he was hanging around here. Are you ready to leave?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's basically the plot outline.
Yeah.
So what did you think of this episode? Because you've gotten taught it. You hadn't rewatched it in a long time.
No, I have not seen it. Had not seen it in many, many years. Decades, perhaps, even. The main thing that occurred to me is this plays very differently in a world where there's no common use of a they pronoun to talk about people with fluid gender identities.
You should explain what, I mean, there is a scene.
There is a scene where, in fact, Riker and Sorin are talking and Riker expresses great frustration at not being able to use personal pronouns to refer to members of Sorin's society.
You had all these controls like you grew up in a shuttle.
I did. My parents were pilots. I was flying with them before I could walk. As soon as I was old enough, I entered flight school. Kreit was my instructor.
He had a good student.
He. Commander, there are no he's or she's in a species without gender.
Okay. For 2 days, I've been trying to construct sentences without personal pronouns. Now I give up. What should I use? It? To us, that's rude.
We use a pronoun that is neutral. I do not think there is really a translation.
Well, then I'll just have to muddle through. So forgive me if the stray he or she slips by, okay?
It just sounds weird. Sorin says, we have a pronoun that doesn't express gender. I don't think there is one in your language. So, which in 1992 is, you know, a statement with which many of the viewers of Star Trek probably would have agreed.
Yeah, we were discussing this beforehand because I was pointing out that I have it on good authority that they has been a non-gendered singular pronoun for a very, very, very long time.
Which was new to me. I did not know that.
Most common reaction to the use of they would probably be to be corrected by your teacher.
Yes. I think that's entirely accurate. They is plural. Right. So expressing a gender preference as a metaphor or an analogy for gayness plays very differently in a world where there isn't awareness of gender fluidity and non-binary folks generally.
It plays different in a world that is pre-Butler, if you want to put it that way. Not in the sense of Butler wasn't writing, but in the sense of that the way that Butlerian understandings of gender have filtered into the popular consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah, gender performativity is not, though it's interesting, the discussion about makeup is, almost gets, like, it would, if one wanted to read that through a kind of Butlerian lens, you'd get some very interesting things out of that.
One of the things that we'll talk about when I talk about how my students have changed in their reception of this is precisely on these issues. Mm. I would make an argument, I'm going to hold off on, that this show actually works better now than it did in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it works terribly well, period. What other kinds of, so beyond the way in which it feels very much of its time and plays differently now, what other kinds of reactions did you have to it?
Well, in general, when, if I'm putting on my thinking about teaching things in sci-fi class, I tend to be very focused on sort of alien encounter kinds of questions. And one thing that's fascinating to me about this episode is, you know, the Prime Directive is referenced, and you'll ruin your career if you do this is said. But clearly Picard could have just ordered the ship to leave, right? It's very much like, I'm going to leave you this opportunity to go ahead and do this thing that we all pay lip service to not interfering. So, and yes, it's kind of a weird gray area.
Well, it's only a misdemeanor in the Prime Directive.
Yeah, I guess.
It's not the felony version.
But the idea, right, if the whole notion of the Prime Directive is, or the spirit of the Prime Directive is, other societies have other ways of doing things and we shouldn't interfere with those ways. That appears to be violatable on a regular basis. And that I found kind of interesting.
Yeah, there's some joke that in the original series, they violated the Prime Directive all the time and everything turned out okay.
Mm-hmm.
The Next Generation, they followed the Prime Directive all the time and things turned out okay. In this episode, they violated the Prime Directive and things didn't turn out okay, I guess. So right. Maybe that's consistent with that rule,
I guess.
But this is interesting to me because, you know, so one of the sayings that's less famous if you're not a fan from Star Trek is the Vulcan proposition of infinite diversity and infinite combination. Mm-hmm. Infinite diversity and infinite combination represents a Vulcan belief that beauty, growth, progress all result from the union of the unlike. Concord, as much as discord, requires the presence of at least two different notes.
Mm-hmm.
This episode is interesting because it runs into the problem of liberal tolerance of the intolerant in a way that is right. Not typical of this era of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about a society that believes in infinite diversity and infinite combination and believes, as we've been told multiple times, the Next Generation, that it's about self-actualization, individual pursuit for its own sake, and the episode where episode that reintroduces the Romans, I think it's called the Neutral Zone, but they pick up a capsule that has cryogenically frozen 21st century humans, and one of them comes out and wants to know about his bank accounts, and Picard's like, we don't have that anymore. This money, this primitive money, we don't do that these days.
Mm-hmm.
And if you hear the way that the Jedi are talking about their view towards gender and their view of social conformity is really antagonistic.
Yeah.
And oppositional to Federation beliefs. And so I think that's kind of interesting. Do you have any thoughts about that beyond noting it?
Well, it's also interesting that, you know, this is a fifth season episode, and so is Iborg. So there's a
individual autonomy is a big thing.
Big deal
right.
Going on here with respect to this.
And its weaponization. But anyway,
we'll come.
Perhaps we'll talk about the Borg at some point.
I would bet that we would end up talking about the Borg at some point. But, well, actually we kind of have to, right? Because if you take that kind of reading of it, then this society, the Genii, are squelching down on the individuality of various people who are there, and that would seem to be opposed to everything the Federation stands for.
The flip side of that, though, is that they remember there's a discussion where Soren explains, she says basically, and I'll use she because that's the preferred pronoun until the very end.
Mm-hmm.
She tells Riker that their view of the society's view of gender is that it's, and she says there's not a polite term for primitive,
yeah.
Less evolved.
Mm-hmm.
So we are more progressive, a more egalitarian society. Some of what we see in this episode suggests that might be the case, that gender inequality is still a problem even in this society. there is some interesting auto-critique going on.
Yeah.
When Soren is going around asking about gender differences, mm-hmm. and also some mm-hmm. stuff that feels a little dated, I think, if you're as a kind of progressive statement on gender. But, you know, in the sense that their view of their society, right, is that they have achieved a better future for everyone,
mm-hmm.
more equal. The Federation's universalism against the Genai particularism, but a particularism which still stipulates that they understand the best way to handle gender interpersonal relations.
Right. And then by contrast, we get Worf, who is cast into the more, like, even more primitive role. Right. He's insisting on traditional kinds of gender roles, but though he can't define the difference between males and females except by grunting. And also, when he goes down to the planet with Riker, he's going down based on some warrior code notion. It's an honor code.
It's an honor code. This is a noble pursuit.
Yeah, there's another end to the temporal continuum there as well. The show is pretty clear in only really giving us, like, centering the human point of view on this. When we get the Genai talking, there's a human there who's skeptical of them, mm-hmm. right? So the show doesn't want you to buy the Genai version of things.
Yeah, pretty clearly.
So, which is part of what makes it extremely ham-handed. It would have been nice to get a straight Genai view that wasn't cast in negative terms, like when the judge is talking.
Mm-hmm. So you've probably heard, you know, this was obviously a gay rights episode.
Yeah.
And the issue of homosexuality, now we'd say LGBTQ, but then we'd say it was really, we thought in terms of LGB, I think, mostly at the mm-hmm. time, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it has a fraught history.
Right.
In the sense that it's somewhere they hadn't gone.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, in phase two, there were discussions about having a background male characters who are in a gay relationship, but just backgrounded, like not, mm-hmm. you know, it was just going to, in the sense that it completely, so completely normal that red shirts.
Right.
You know, might be in, you know, this is a show that in the first episode, the men are wearing skirts.
Right.
Or these skirt uniforms, mm-hmm. in part an apologia for the short skirts that the women wore in the original series.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and it hadn't tackled homosexuality or gayness or sexual minorities in any way. There's that Star Trek versus Star Wars thing. You know, the message of all Star Trek is don't be racist to aliens.
Right, right, exactly.
And the story is that Frakes afterwards, the guy, Jonathan Frakes, who plays Riker, has said that he believes they chickened out, that they should have cast Soren with a male actor, not with a female actor.
Yeah, that would have been very interesting. That would have been extremely interesting.
So as a gay rights episode, it's weird because it is... So this is 1992.
Mm-hmm.
Is this forward-leaning, or is it not because it can't actually say gay?
Right. Yeah.
What do you think? Is this at some level an effective way of tackling this in 1992? This is, of course, we're about to have the big fight over gays in the military,
right.
and which concludes with Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As I try to think through that, the answer to that question, I was just having to look up exactly when the episode was. But in the previous season, was the episode The Host? And in some
Beverly
ways...
Beverly rejects that.
Where question. Beverly rejects the...
You should explain this.
Yeah, so the setup of...
In something that we now know as a perversion from the troll perspective.
Yes. But okay, so the way that The Host is set up, there's an
introduction of a race that becomes much more important, species that becomes much more important in Star Trek from DS9 and then Discovery.
So because we have a trillion character, but they're a symbiotic race, and what they are is there's the actual being is slug-like thing that needs a host, a body.
It's a symbiote.
And I haven't actually watched The Host in many years, but there's a character who is one of these, and is the host body is dying.
Yeah, and he's a crucial mediator, and I think he is injured in an attack.
Yeah, and he needs and in order to have the mediation continue, he needs a new host. Bobby.
So he's put in
Riker.
Riker, right?
So he's put in Riker.
The symbiote.
The symbiote is put in Riker. Now, before this time, the character had been kind of flirting with the Doctor, with Dr. Crusher.
Yeah, they were heading towards.
They were heading toward some sort of a relationship.
Were they even entered it already?
Either they had or they had.
We didn't rewatch it.
They're either heading that way or they're already there.
Right. Romance is in the air.
Romance is definitely in the air. The love enterprise
in the space.
but then the symbiote is transferred into Riker's body. Mm-hmm. Now the Riker, Jonathan Frakes is now playing this different character who is the symbiote.
Yeah, it's also interesting because the way that the host symbiote relationship is portrayed in this episode,
it's different.
It's different because it really seems like the symbiote takes over.
Yeah,
but in later episodes, it's understood as being
much more mutual playable. And yeah. But so at least in this in this particular thing, it's Riker is not there. Mm-hmm. Riker's body is sort of being driven by this other character, and that character then tries to continue the relationship with the Doctor.
Which in Riker's body they
in Riker's do. Body and that she can buy that,
but then Riker's body is of course rejecting
Riker's
the host.
Body is rejecting the host, so they need a more permanent host. They get a new host. The new host is biologically female, mm-hmm. and the symbiote is implanted in the female.
And the host comes to Beverly to continue the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And Beverly is just like, no,
I can't do it. Yeah. I can't do this. But she wrestles and she wrestles with this and ultimately just can't get over her own kind of what we would now call heteronormativity when it comes to this stuff.
Although we could also argue, you could construct alternative narratives for what she can't deal with if you really wanted to retcon the thing.
Yeah, I mean, sure. But it seems to me that episode was a really honest exploration of the difficulty of certain kinds of claims about gay rights because the reactions are not rational ones, they're emotional ones. Beverly doesn't give reasons why she can't. It's just, it's kind of, ugh.
Well, I mean, I think if you were heterosexual, you were required to.
No, but the episode is a good diagnosis of a certain kind of reaction.
I think what it does is it's an encounter in which we have a prominent character rejecting a same-sex relationship.
Yep.
So however we read the nuances of it, that's how it comes across.
Right.
So, yeah, you're right. It's interesting that in this season, they do their allegorical gay rights episode. Now, I've already mentioned, I think the speech is actually pretty good for an episode that is, I think, largely kind of a misfire.
Yeah, it's clumsy.
Yeah. It's clumsy. It requires a lot of breaking of character. Riker is not behaving the way that we're used to him behaving. This is not character driving narrative. It's narrative driving character.
Right. No, that's fair. That's fair.
I wanted to mention this auto-critique stuff because I think that's pretty interesting. Mm. Even in 1992, I think this was pretty obvious when she's going around asking about how people experience gender and what are the differences between the sexes. People give answers and they're deeply uncomfortable with the answers.
Yeah.
And the answers about it, and when she asks about makeup, it's an interesting moment. Obviously, the men in behind camera also have makeup on, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the makeup is naturalistic.
Right.
And you have these characters hundreds of years in the future who are definitely performing very heteronormative understandings of gender.
Yes.
And Soren kind of points out the awkwardness of this in context of what Star Trek espouses. And they're all sitting around talking about equality, but
right.
It gets at some of the tensions of an equality feminism that doesn't want to deal with performative gender difference.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Because the alternative to gender hierarchy is presented as the abolition of gender, as opposed to some more fluid understanding of gender performance.
Well, I think the crew is trying to get across the point that we can be different and also equal. You know, in essence, that it may seem weird and a little clumsy, but this is, you know, we are in an era of equality.
Mm-hmm.
And wants to decouple some of those things that we would now, I think a lot of more critical feminists, I mean, at the time, I was taking feminist theory courses at the time, that this stuff is new, would argue is itself gendered in a way which reproduces forms of oppression. You have that interesting moment where Riker asks Soren, well, who leads?
Yeah. Yeah. Who leads when you dance?
If you haven't watched the episode before this, when Soren asks Beverly Crusher about makeup and how men don't present themselves that way, she gives a very kind of cultured gender account of, you know, well, women want to make themselves attractive, men do too, but they
Doctor,
don't
you are female.
Yes.
Forgive me, I do not mean to be rude, but I'm curious. What is it like?
Well, it's just the way I am. I've never really thought about what it's like.
I notice you tend to have longer hair, and you arrange it more elaborately, and you apply color to your bodies.
Color?
You put color on your mouth, and your eyes, your cheeks, and your fingernails. The men don't.
That's true.
Then it is up to women to attract the men.
Oh, no. Men want to be attractive, too. Believe me, they just go about it differently.
No color.
No color. They like to pretend they're not doing anything to attract a woman, even when it's the most important thing on their minds.
This is very confusing. Then, are women considered more superior? Or the men?
Neither. In the past, women were often considered weak and inferior. But that hasn't been true for a long time.
So, which is, again, there is it highly, highly gender coded.
So I started teaching this course, and I think I showed the film, might have been the second time I taught it. So we're talking about mid-2000s. And so when I start teaching it, this is before Obergefell. This is actually not long after the Republicans use constitutional amendments banning gay marriage as a voter mobilization tool in the 2004 election.
Right.
And my students, I think, viewed it, well, for one thing, much more charitably. They emphasized that they found Soren's speech effective.
Mm-hmm.
They thought that it was, yeah, a little bit transparent, but they didn't have as much a problem with it as I think maybe even I did at the time.
Mm.
They also talked about some interesting stuff, which is they talked a lot about how their attitudes towards homosexuality were normalized, you know, those of them, I guess, who were heteronormative or whatever, I had gay students, obviously, that a lot of this was normalized through television.
Hmm.
And they talked a lot about Modern Family.
Interesting.
The way that they often articulated this was a thing pro the episode. Television is a really important medium to communicate these kinds of messages, even if you're not doing it as well as you could have.
Right.
It was less removed for them, so obviously 18 to 22-year-olds by the mid-2000s were very pro gay rights in general and pro SSM. Like, you know, we saw that wave coming.
Right.
And even my conservative students, you know, my Bush voters, for example, would say, oh yeah, this is stupid. Like, gay marriage is fine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know whether that was performative. It's a liberal school, but this was to me in private. And I was always pretty clear. I would tolerate, you know, right. I wasn't going to get angry at you if you had beliefs that were different from mine. Generally, like, that was the kind of way that they reacted to it. They got a little bit of the, you know, what does it mean that a show that considers itself the most progressive vision of the future, between the producers and the writers, they could not bring themselves to do an explicit gay, you know, an episode with gay people in it, or even have an actor, a male actor, portray a genderless, a quote unquote genderless love interest. There's nothing like that now.
No.
I have had multiple students be incredibly puzzled about why they don't just say they when talking about Soren.
Mm-hmm.
They are much more likely to read it as a trans episode. In fact, if my students don't look it up,
mm-hmm.
they just read it as a trans
episode.
But they have actually very little idea about changing cultural norms on these issues. And I think that's one of the interesting things about it. I think it actually works a bit better as a trans rights episode.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. It does, because the difference in the societies is really not a heterosexual, homosexual issue. It's really much more of a gender distinction.
Mm-hmm.
And the metaphor doesn't work as well. I mean, the here is somebody who is considered a sexual deviant in their society, and they're going to be corrected. Okay, fine. That part sort of works, but the mechanics of it don't really map as well. But for trans stuff, I think
because what it does is
better.
It sets up a relationship where the humans in the Federation are more quote unquote gender diverse, right? Even though they're very heteronormative in many ways.
Exactly.
So it's more symmetrical, parallel, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, and there are no non-binary Federation characters at this point.
Yeah. Right. There won't be until a few years ago.
Yeah. And just that very contrast itself kind of makes this much more, I think, as you said, effective as a trans rights episode, even though it's not at all the way it was written or the way it was done in its original context.
So one of the arguments I saw floated around back in the 90s about this episode by people, I read a favorable review of this episode once that argued that it had these multiple meanings, you know, so it starts out as a gay rights episode, but it then claims that it is in some ways a critique of certain strains of feminism.
Hmm.
And the argument is that if you think about what the society does, it's eliminated gender difference.
Right.
And that is a form, and that translates into a form of oppression. And think about certain discourses about certain kinds of feminism in the 90s.
Okay.
I've broached that to my students over the years. None of them buy it. None of them see it. But I mean, what do you think?
If you're familiar with the history of certain kinds of caricatures of feminist thinking, then you could read this as a critique.
Conservative critics of feminism argue that it wanted to eliminate gender difference.
Right. Right. And that's what we see is, look, the elimination of gender difference and the elimination of gender difference in a very all-encompassing sort of totalitarian way and with the criminalization of illness, basically, right? Because you're sick, you're a deviant, that is anything outside of the norm. Mm-hmm. So it's like all of the sort of standard, like authoritarian nightmare stuff is like all crammed in there together with what Soren society with the Genii are actually doing. But it's, I don't know. I mean, this isn't what most feminists were actually arguing. So, you know, this is again why I think it's a weird analogy for like a gay rights thing, because it's the opposite of gayness is not two genders.
Yeah, but what it's trying to do is it's trying to create a situation where heterosexual relationships are outlawed, you know, and are considered deviant. And mm-hmm. it does that by not by making same-sex relationships normative, but by having every relationship be a same-sex relationship.
Kind of. I mean, in a way, it would have been more interesting if it had actually been a society in which homosexuality was legislated and mandated.
Yeah, or had been socially conformed to. Think about the Forever War.
Yeah. That would be interesting, because then it would be like, okay, now what we've actually got here is the society is kind of a mirror that we can see the politics of that playing out.
So just if you don't know, the Forever War is a book that's in many ways about Vietnam, But it's a book, it's a sci-fi book in which humans are fighting an alien race, but they're fighting it in relativistic time. So soldiers are going off and fighting, and lots of time is passing. So one of the soldiers who we follow gets far enough in the future that everybody's gay now, and he's the odd duck out. And there's mm-hmm. this scene where one of his lieutenants tries to drink enough. They feel bad for him. So she tries to get drunk enough that she can have heterosexual sex, and she just can't do it. But it's about this idea that war, taken out of your home and coming back and the home being unrecognizable. Mm-hmm. And it's done through time dilation.
Yeah.
Did you ever sign Forever War? Is that something we're going to talk about?
I've never assigned it.
Okay.
It'd be interesting to talk about. It's been
I don't know.
A long
time. We got a lot of stuff on the list. I mean, if we're going to have to do Ender's Game and you can see me rolling my eyes.
Yes, I can see you
rolling your probably, eyes. Then probably, and we're going to do Starship Troopers, then probably we should do the Forever War too. But,
yeah, probably.
But so, yeah, I mean, my students never go in for that, have never gone in for that reading. They've always found it perplexing.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing that has been interesting, and it's something that's a little bit uncomfortable about the episode, is that this episode presents a society where conversion therapy seems to work.
Right. Right.
Because it's very early in the semester and in the class, I usually just pose this as a very direct question. If conversion therapy actually worked in this way, would it be bannable? And you know, what about the argument that now Soren is happy and well-adjusted?
Right.
Right. How do you deal with that?
Yeah. How do they respond?
They ultimately, I think, in various different words, argue that there's been violence done against Soren's identity. That Soren's been changed in a way that is an impermissible intrusion by the state mm-hmm. and by authorities on her being. In the way that they read that, I think, and I that's how I sometimes like think I probably read it, is the way in which she is so utterly transformed in some respects that she doesn't even seem like the same person.
Right. She speaks, her manner of speaking is different. Mm. Her posture is even different.
In that then, so they generally say no. You know, they basically, generally they're like, no, you know, not going to go there. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm. A, it doesn't matter because it doesn't work.
Right.
B, it doesn't matter because even if it worked, it's torture. And then C, it seems to still be bad in some way mm-hmm. because of this way in which it seems to have been a reworking of her identity.
Right.
In a way that she never doesn't consent to.
Right.
The more interesting thing that sometimes comes out of that, though, is this question about to what degree is sexual identity and preference tied up with identity?
Right.
Right? The sort of, in very kind of crude ways, the Foucault argument that that sexual orientation is discrete and insular and immutable characteristic mm-hmm. versus, I guess, a more traditional stance. So it does raise this issue about the connection between how much is your identity right. a function of who you want to fuck.
And what I would find interesting might be to sort of pair this episode with reading History of Sexuality
yeah.
and saying, okay, so let's take a look at this, because there is the medicalization of sexual deviance in exactly the same way, and you think you're not happy at the moment because you're sick, but now that you're well, now you're perfectly happy. And she says at the end, well, they say at the end that mm-hmm. that they're better now, and they no longer have any of these feelings for Riker. And there's no indication in the episode that Soren still does have any of these sorts of feelings.
Yeah, I don't think there's, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think there's any way to interpret the last look she gives him as anything but fully sincere, that she just feels sad that she's...
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And her sickness had brought him into this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, it is a...
I guess they don't go by they go by he or she, so we're going to be true to the episode they tell us,
I think in our...
Do we have to respect a pronoun if it's been imposed that way?
Because by referring to her as she, then we're rejecting the episode.
We're
rejecting the Janai treat. And in fact, we're doing what Riker does. But then, are we misgendering her? Is Riker misgendering her? by calling her a her. Mm. And then this also runs into, you've mentioned it before, but the production decision to cast a female actor in that role matters. We read a female actor playing that role differently than we would read a male actor playing that role. And I don't know, how would that episode go if they had had the courage, perhaps, to cast a male actor in that role? I don't know. Not that that would have been plausible in 1982. I can't imagine them having done that.
I mean, now there would be no question doing it. I mean, in most settings, I guess, probably, like,
well, no, the issue now would be, do you cast a non-binary person in that role?
Yeah, and is it illegitimate if you
don't? Is it illegitimate if you don't, right? But that would not even have been a question 30 years ago, so.
Do you cast a non-binary person in a role of somebody who is in the closet binary?
Ooh. I'm glad I'm not a casting director.
So the answer is you wouldn't write this episode.
You wouldn't write this episode. You wouldn't do it this way. No, you definitely would not do this.
But I think, yeah. I mean, fundamentally though, I think I hope this conversation and your rewatching gives you a sense of why I assign this as the first thing.
Yeah.
Right. Why it, because it is amenable to all of these different readings.
Right.
All the kind of toolkit, you know, it's amenable to a reading of what is the argument in mm-hmm. the political theoretic sense. It's amenable to a reading of what does the say about the period. It's amenable to a discussion about the role of popular cultural representation in naturalizing or normalizing certain types of things about the world, making mm-hmm. things plausible. And it does raise some interesting counterfactual questions, even if it doesn't pursue them very much.
Yeah, no, it makes a great deal of sense in terms of opening up all of those different threads of discussion. Whereas what I tend to do, which I think is what we're going to talk about next time, is some of the short stories that I often lead
so
with.
So what are we going to do next?
So I've led with a number of different things over the years, but one that I particularly like is this pairing of Ursula Le Guin's Those Who Walk Away from O'Malley's with the response story that N.K. Jemisin wrote to that, which is called Those Who Stay and Fight.
And we're going to read that for the next In Space episode.
For the next In Space, we'll read those two. The other one that I have been, and it's interesting because I taught it in the sci-fi class this time, but before I've done that, I've taught it in about four other classes just because it's such an evocative and brilliant story. There's this story called We Who Stole the Dream, and it is written by...
You can't see, I'm like tilting my head in that quizzical golden retriever sense.
Yes.
What is this? What are you talking about?
No, a story called We Who Stole the Dream, and it was written by James Tiptree Jr., who is somewhat famously a pen name, and her actual name was Alice Sheldon. Mm-hmm. And We Who Stole the Dream is a marvelous critique of both colonialism and anti-colonialism. It's just a fascinating story. Humans are the bad guys, and the oppressed alien race ends up perhaps turning into just another empire, and that's a bad thing, and it's understood that there's spiritual costs associated with liberation, and it's really absolutely fascinating. And I love teaching it in a lot of different classes. So this year I did that. The last time I taught the class, I did that in addition to those other two stories. So I'm not sure whether for next time we'll do all three stories or whether we'll just do two of them. We'll go from there.
I think we're going to do them both, we decided, right?
Yeah.
Because so much of what you do is in the intertext,
the
interplay. Sure. Now, do you assign any readings with these things? Because this readings that I assign with this episode, we didn't talk about, and I don't think we're going to. I mean, I briefly summarized them.
Yeah. The first thing is just these. I just do these to start off with. Another difference also, and we should mention this, between the way we teach the classes, any of the visual media that I show, I don't show in class.
I don't show it in class either.
I show it as like a separate film series that kind of goes along.
I don't do a series. I just give them assignments to watch things. So that's what you mean. Not in class, but yeah. It's not for class in the same way that a book would be.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So I show a lot of that stuff as supplemental. So I do, and I usually get, you know, a large number of people from the class showing up at these quote unquote voluntary film shows.
I feel extremely awkward doing those things. Like I did one for my first years and all these kids showed up. We had pizza and stuff, but I just feel awkward doing them. I don't know.
Hmm.
We don't have a good place to do this that I have access to in Georgetown. Like classrooms are awful.
Yeah, classrooms are terrible.
Like we need like a place that has in the boardroom in the Matara Center is also kind of big and hard, right?
This last year they gave me a room in the library in the audiovisual center, which was nice. It's not theater seating, so you're around a conference table and you've got a TV about the size of that one that's behind you, it's on the wall, and so it's nice and big. And once I got into the menu and changed the color options on the TV so that the films look watchable, because they were really washed out. I'm like, what is going on with this thing? But apparently, you can go and tweak it. And it was nice because then you'd get, you know, 6-7 students sitting around a table, and then you would show whatever it was, and then we would talk for half an hour, and then go out, and that was great. The disadvantage, of course, is it was in the library AV center, so you couldn't have food. So I'm not gonna. I will not, however, weigh in on the question of whether or not we did have any food. So I'm just gonna say we were not permitted.
Yeah,
to.
I think
just like
food
the prime directive
is technically banned in a lot of the classrooms I'm in.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is some of those times where, you know, I really wish, particularly as I'm getting to be older and I'm a little bit more grandfatherly, I guess, I don't know, that, you know, I had a house near campus where, you know, I could just have students come and we could, you know.
Yeah. But neither of us can live in Northwest D.C., so.
Well, I certainly can't live in Georgetown.
Yeah, and I certainly can't live in Amy Park.
So I'm going to suggest, and you may have to just do that with me, that you watch the Strange New Worlds episode, which is a ripoff or homage to Those Who Walk Away, which is called Lift Us Where Suffering Cannot Reach.
Cool.
And do that. And
yeah,
maybe if you listeners want to do that, you should do that.
That sounds like a great idea. I didn't realize that they had done that.
Yeah,
cool.
It's interesting because Maya's reaction was this is just a ripoff. I think she... mellowed a bit on that, but in mine was, it's an homage, right? But I think my views certainly crystallized along it's an homage when I went online to forums and saw people saying, I really like this episode. And I was saying, do you know this is like a short story?
Mm-hmm.
And people say, I didn't know that. I'll go read it now.
Yeah.
Right. Gateway drugs to other sci-fi, I suppose.
Well, and as long as we're talking about gateway drugs to other sci-fi and other kinds of traditions, it's clear to me that the writers of The Outcast were familiar with The Left Hand of Darkness, right? It's just that Le Guin does it so much better in Left Hand of Darkness.
Yeah, I can't wait till we discuss that because there are a bunch of reasons I do not assign it.
Mm. I don't assign Left Hand of Darkness.
I thought you used to.
I did. I think I did the... Did I do? I have to check and see whether I actually assigned it or whether I just had it as a supplemental text. I always give them the introduction to the Left Hand of Darkness, which is
because
stunningly brilliant thing about the way the science fiction works. No, the Le Guin novel that I've taught the most is The Dispossessed.
Yeah, same with me. It's on every
So we're gonna have to do The Dispossessed.
Yeah, I think there's been one syllabus it hasn't been on, and as I've told you before, I think it pairs really well with The Player of Games because it is structurally
Yeah.
I still have to believe that Banks was doing something with that. It's just too structurally similar.
Right. Here's one. Now I'm somewhere else. Yep.
I'm unhappy with where I am. I think I want something different. I'm going to go do something different. I'm going to get my sense of like, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, without giving anything away, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't have the chronological stuff because it's not one of the Banks books that's written in an uber literary form. But
right. Right.
I like the use of weapons, but...
Yeah. Oh, jeez. Which I've not
ever I've taught assigned. It once. I like that. It's the whole thing about, like, can I really get a... Is it really fair for me to sign two Ian Banks books?
Yeah.
But damn it, I want to.
Yeah. The only Banks book I've ever assigned is Look to Windward.
Okay, so we know what we're going to read next time. We're not 100% sure what we're going to read after that.
But we have some.
But we will announce it, and we will get that syllabus. All right, it's been fun. Cool. Yes,
definitely. Look forward to the next time. I suppose we have to, given that we did a whole Star Trek thing, I think we have to do like the Star Trek sign-off, right? We have to do Live Long and Prosper.
All right, okay.
Right, because that's...
I don't know. Certain meanings of have to. Remember, Next Generation has no Vulcans.
No, it
Instead
doesn't.
Of a guy who wants to run away from his humanity, we have an android who wants to be human. Okay, so I'm going to...
The Star Trek people would come after us if you actually put the Star Trek theme music here at the end, wouldn't they?
I'm not gonna. Yeah, we don't need gimmicks here.
No,
at International Relations Theory we in don't need space.
Gimmicks. We don't need gimmicks.
We don't need gimmicks.
Okay.
We're carried simply by the delightfulness of our commentary.
Uh huh.
Our whiskey selections.
Clearly, that's
in our dulcet voices
and our merchandise.
Our merchandise. Yeah, we'll talk about the merchandise later.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Because you know. All five or six people who are out there who are desperate for merchandise, we have merchandise now.
Hey, I bought a mug.
Yeah, I bought a bunch of things to hand out to friends of the cast.
Yeah.
So
excellent.
All right.
All right.
So, okay. So long.
Bye.
Bye.